We are sitting down in Bozeman, Montana with Saul Martinez.
Saul Martinez.
Ooh, yeah. That's fancy. Okay. I like that even better. And I reached out to your, I found you guys through a Google, I can't even talk today. I found you guys through a Google search. So it's Warriors in Quiet Waters is the organization who you're representing. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to sit down with you and listen to your story and give you kind of a little bit of space to be able to just talk and for me to listen and for anybody out there to listen to. So,
oh, okay.
So you have the floor.
Well, I guess I don't know where to start. Do I start from where I'm born? Or where I was born? I was born in Hollywood, California, and raised by two awesome parents. My mom and my dad are both, Mexican, and I've got an awesome brother. And along with most Mexican families, it's a really big one. My dad has 7 brothers and sisters, and nice. I have a lot of cousins, and we're all pretty tight. So that's kind of the beginning. Is I grew up in a really very supportive, very loving family that was just always happy to see each other. I feel pretty thankful about the foundation that I have growing up. It's a big part of who I am, actually. So fast forward to high school. I did all of the sports, really. I played football, I wrestled, I swam. So the entire year was taken up by sport, and I also did competition cheerleading for 2 years, which was nice. Fun, because, I don't really have a good reason other than I really enjoyed it. It was good. Side note on that one, I love to dance, and there was a lot of dancing involved in cheerleading. So after high school, worked for a little bit, a couple of jobs here and there. During that time, I was with my high school sweetheart, who's still my wife to this day.
Awesome.
Yeah, we've been married for 15 years. Our anniversary is coming up in June. Yeah, so let's backtrack a little bit to when I joined the Army, and that was about 3 years after I graduated high school. And during those 3 years, I always felt that urge, that almost like an obligation to join, because growing up in a Mexican family that, everybody just did their best, and they were so focused on survival, really, in this country. So I always wanted to do my part for this country that gave our family so much, I guess is what I'm trying to say. And I also wanted to protect it, not only serve it, but protect it. And when it finally came down to it, I had to satisfy that need, that call to duty, if you will. It's kind of a stereotypical way of putting it, but it really was for me. Once I actually joined as an infantryman, and because I knew that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to fight the bad guys. I wanted to be immersed in that unit and that camaraderie mentality, and it was great. I have zero regrets about joining the military and joining the Army. So about a year after I joined, I deployed to Iraq in 2007 during the surge as an infantryman. And one day, and the reason why I'm telling, why I'm saying this is because it's like a new starting point that I had in my life. Mm-hmm. Everything before that was all great, and it was, just life. And then one day we were on mission. We got hit by it's called an EFP, it's explosively formed penetrator. And what that is essentially is it's a very simple yet very elegant and very effective type of improvised explosive device. It's basically a cylinder, and it's made out of, different kinds of materials, but the cylinder is the housing for all of the explosives and all the shrapnel that they pack into it. At the back, they cap it off with a detonator, and in the front, they put a copper plate, and that copper plate acts as the penetrator. And the reason why I'm saying this is because I want to try to give everybody a scope of the damage that this thing could do. And it was actually responsible, I believe, for 80% of the casualties that we took in Iraq in 2007. So back to the EFP, that copper plate, once it's detonated, the explosives that are packed behind it turn that copper plate essentially into a giant, really hot bullet that shreds through anything. And when I say anything, about a week before our mission, we saw one go through an Abrams tank. And an Abrams tank is a, you know, it's like you see in the movies. It's a big old tank. It's perceivably impenetrable. But the EFP is that deadly and it's that effective that it can pierce the armor of an Abrams. So what we were riding in was the Humvee. And at that time, there were the new ones with, you know, big up armored doors, armored windows, and all of the above. Each door was about 450 pounds. So when you combined the EFP with more of them, it just increases its effectiveness. And the charge that hit us was anywhere from 6 to 8 charges. Each one of them was about 10 to 12 inches in diameter. So the bigger the diameter, and I promise this, I know this is kind of a little boring, but I got to give you guys the scope of what this weapon could do. And once, you know, the bigger the diameter of the copper plate, the bigger the bullet, the more damage it does. And the more power behind it, because the bigger the cylinder, the more explosives they could pack behind it. So we were in a Humvee, myself, my two buddies, Kyle Little and Blake Stevens. Once that thing hit us, it blew two of the doors off and just shred through our Humvee like it wasn't even there. Kyle and Blake were unfortunately killed instantly. And as a result, I became a bilateral amputee. I'm a right above knee and a left below knee. With a flurry of other wounds, I have some massive tissue loss on one of my legs, shrapnel everywhere. I can't get an MRI right now, or ever, because I have too much shrapnel left in me. And, you know, if you don't know, an MRI is magnetic, so a lot of that shrapnel could travel, so it's just too much of a risk for me to get an MRI, which would have come in handy during all of these years for some of the conditions and some of the things that have popped up. But so there's the new starting point in my life. Once we were hit with that, and I lost Kyle and Blake, I also need to mention my medic and my squad leader, along with my entire team that was with us. But my medic and my squad leader, Mike Henderson and Stephanie McCulley, which, women in combat, that's an entirely different subject, and I'm pretty partial because I've seen a badass woman in combat. And I've seen her do her job and do it. What's the rules on cursing on the podcast?
Say whatever the fuck you want.
She's a fucking badass. Like I saw her do her fucking job like a boss. She saved my life. She packed dressing in places where, you know, bleeding wouldn't stop. She cut me out of my harness, and so did Mike. And, you know, it was, anyway, women in combat, that could be an entirely different podcast on its own. And just for the lady veterans out there, I'm with you.
Nice.
And I'm with you forever. So get out of there. I was medevaced right after that. The birds came about 20 minutes after we were hit, got to Baghdad, and that's the last. And the other thing I should mention is I have the, you know, people say it all the time when things are a blessing and a curse. Mm-hmm. For me, it's very real. It is a blessing and a curse, but I remember everything from blast to getting to the hospital in Baghdad.
Oh, wow.
So I remember how Blake looked. I remember Kyle not being there because he was actually ejected once we got hit. And then the last thing I remember was, you know, closing my eyes at the, it's called the Combat Support Hospital, the 20th Cache in Baghdad. And then I was in an induced coma for about a week and a half before I woke up. And the first thing I woke up to was my wife. And I remember clear as day how she looked and what she was saying. And then very shortly after I woke up, my mom and dad and my brother were there too. And it was very kind of a surreal experience because, you know, for anybody that's been, you know, in who's experienced, you know, physical trauma like that or lost limbs or have been in a coma, there's a lot of drugs involved. And a lot of it was, I venture to say freaking hallucinogenic. Mm-hmm. Because it took a long time. I mean, it's been 14 years, and to this day, people are still giving me little pieces here and there. as I ask for them, because a lot of the times that people aren't really comfortable sharing that stuff because they don't know how I'm going to receive it, which is fine. And I appreciate that, actually. So empathy, we'll get to that. But once I got out of the coma, and there was a lot of care after that, I was still in the ICU for a little while after that. And, you know...
Are you back in the U.S. at this point?
I am, yeah. Okay. Yep. So once I got from Baghdad, boom, they put me in a coma. They stabilized me enough to get from Baghdad to Balad, another spot in Iraq where most of the medevacs exfil from. And then from Balad to Landstuhl, Germany, which, side note on that, my wife, they called my wife and said, you need to go get an emergency passport. We got orders on the way. You got to go pick it up because we got to fly you to Germany. They wouldn't tell her exactly why, but essentially they were telling her, you need to go to Germany to watch your husband die. Mm-hmm. And which I did. I actually flatlined twice. Once there in Baghdad, and then again in Landstuhl. But the awesome medical staff and everybody that was taking care of me, I owe them a lot. Because everybody did their part to keep me here. So yeah, I think I'll pause there. Because I think that was a little bit, a little bit much.
Do you need water or anything?
No, I'm good. No, okay. You know what? No matter how many times I say it, like it just gets there.
Yeah.
Get a little emotional because it's still like it happened yesterday. Which is fine because it keeps me in touch with the past. You know, it's a piece of my heart that will always be there. Mm-hmm. So, I do a lot of things with my heart and emotions and feelings mean the world to me. So, yeah, so I'm good.
Just breathe and take
your time. Yeah, take a breath and then we'll continue. But, I'm always curious. Let's fast forward to where I am today.
Okay.
And then I'm going to probably pop back and do some callbacks here and there. But what I'd like people to know... Let's just start there, and apologies for anybody listening if I start to ramble, is that, you know, everybody, just imagine a world if everybody had a little more empathy. Mm-hmm. Everybody has problems, everybody has struggles, everybody's been through stuff, you know, some have been, you know, when there's a comparison made, it's invalidating for other people who... Their struggle might not be on the same level as yours, but it's still their struggle, and it's still, to them, might be on the same level as yours. So I've noticed that a lot over time in traveling and meeting so many people in, being in interviews, people coming up to me or people writing me and saying, like, you know, what you said really resonated with me. And I'm like, cool, that's the goal, because my story is, I mean, yeah, it's mine, but... Because of what happened in Iraq, I feel like this story belongs to everybody. Mm-hmm. And that includes, I've never tried to get any personal gain from it. I've never wanted to gain anything from it, because to me, the value is in sharing the story. Mm-hmm. To me, the value is in sharing the stuff nobody really wants to talk about or ask about, which is the struggle or the climb. Or the process, you know, that's important, and it fucking sucks that nobody ever asks about it, because all they see, you know, and you know, to everybody's credit, not everybody knows how to interact in certain ways with certain people, and I get that. Some people, you know, are in their own world with their own people, with their own friends, in their own circle, with their own culture. Even, and we're talking about stuff that spans cultures, right? When people see me today, a lot of the comments I get is like, oh yeah, you're an inspiration. Oh, you're doing so well. Oh, you're doing great. It's like, yeah, I kind of know. Like it's fine. Like I know I walk. I know I can do things. I appreciate you observing that, but that's not really the shit that matters to me. To mm-hmm. me, because I find a lot of comfort and a lot of, what's another word I'm trying, I do this often, I try to remember words, So if there's anybody out there that struggles with brain farts, I am the master.
Yes. All the time. Yeah. Which is probably why I don't talk very much during these either.
Oh, well, I want to hear about you too, you know? So when, you know, I find a lot of, I don't know, maybe I could call it, you know, when people seek affirmation, oh, that's a different animal. Like, I don't even get into that one because I feel like people on Facebook and social media, a lot of them are just looking for that external validation when they, like, post all the time and post things that I'm just like, I don't really care. Like, okay, cool. Good for you. That's awesome. But when people talk about the things that find them, that bring them joy, man, I'm there for that shit. Mm-hmm. I'm there for it because it's almost like, you know, I don't want to call myself an empath, but I've been described as such. And when I see people find joy or find happiness or even grief and sorrow, I absorb it so hard and I try to feel it as if they are feeling it. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of benefit to that. Not just to me, but to the person who I'm listening to or the person who's opening up to me or the person who's sharing their story. Even when I hear it and I don't know the person, they're a complete stranger and it's on a podcast or it's on social media, I sit there and I fucking feel it. And sometimes it takes me a little while to recover because I feel it so hard that it's like, it's almost like it's happening to myself. Mm-hmm. So I feel like if people just took a step back and maybe thought, no, you know what? I'm going to go back because I think a lot of the times people find comfort in the ease of not asking those questions. Mm-hmm. Also because there's some interaction conflict there. If, you know, they don't want to get too personal, maybe it's just maybe it's a transactional interaction. Maybe it's a professional interaction, whatever it is. If they're not comfortable asking, that tells me enough. And it's like, cool. I don't want to share that with you anyway. Awesome. But if, you know, you can kind of tell if a person is wanting to hear that stuff. I pick up on certain mannerisms and things people say to actually gauge their interest. Are you asking me because this will help you in some way? Or are you asking me because you want to tell a story later on to your friends? Mm-hmm. Which that's happened many times in the past. And then once you tell, so it's vulnerability is another big part. I don't know if you're a fan of Brené Brown, but yes. I just absolutely love her.
Right, the Daring to Be Good.
Yeah,
and then listen to her, her podcast too, the Dare to Lead.
Yeah. Oh yeah, she's.
I want her on my podcast so bad.
Oh, she is. Not only is her voice like smooth jazz to me,
yeah,
but I really dig when people, especially like Renee, phrase things and phrase subject matter in ways that I can understand in this fucked up brain that I have. So when she says things and she puts things that I've thought about but can't actually
like
articulate, thank you, or put into words, that, you know, when she says them, I'm just like, oh, beautiful, man. It feels so, like, it might sound a little weird, but it feels really good in my brain.
Mm-hmm.
It like starts here and then it just like cascades through my whole body. Mm-hmm. When somebody just, you know, whether it's a light bulb or whether it's like, my daughter likes to call them brain splashes, because we've talked about it over time because she actually does that for me. She's done that for me since she was like
brain splashes.
Oh yeah.
I'm going to write that down.
Nice. It's that moment, and anybody can have that. Anybody can, whether you're interested in something, whether it's something that, crosses your path that you haven't thought about in a while, but somebody says it in a way that you're just like, oh yeah, yeah, I fucking get it. Like I like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think anybody can have those, no matter what the subject matter is. And my daughter and my daughter, my son, my wife, and a lot of, and the people that are, you know, really close to me do that for me. And I'm really thankful because I think a lot of the times they do it intentionally because they know, like, oh man, if I frame this in the right way for Saul, he's going to feel really good and it's going to make sense to him. And then it's going to increase his productivity. It's going to better his mood. It's going to maybe even help him sleep better. Like that. I've had big ones like that where it's just like, it's like a weight's been lifted because I was so stuck in some of those thoughts, whether it's like, you know, shame is a big, I mean, Brene talks about shame a lot, and affirmation and connection and all those things. And when, so anyway, I'm kind of rambling on there too, but when people talk to me and they want to know about, like, let's say something small, like, hey, Saul, do your legs ever hurt? I don't get to ask that question very often. And when they ask it, I'm just like, yeah, dude, all the fucking time. Mm-hmm. All the time. I can't remember the actor's name, but from House, he said a line in that show that said, he said, you know, I live in pain. I wake up, I'm in pain. I go to work, I'm in pain. And that's kind of the case for me. A lot of people don't really know that. You know, only the select few that are, you know, close to me know that I'm in pain, and I'm actually feeling kind of vulnerable even sharing that with an audience. But like you said when we started, is, you know, if what I'm saying will help somebody in some way, then I'm fucking here for it. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm sharing that, is but the pain doesn't control me, is the other thing I want to say, is because sometimes it's big pain. Sometimes it's just like, ugh, man, annoying. And everybody has that too. They don't have to have lost their legs or have tissue loss or wounds that they have to constantly put Band-Aids or Tecoderm or ointment on. Like, it's, everybody has pain. I think pain's a great equalizer, because I think we could find common ground in pain. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people, like I said, don't want to go there because it's tough. So when, you know, I think when people, I just wish people were more interested in the struggle. Mm-hmm. is what I think I'm trying to say. Or the climb, for that matter. I've even had people, you know, kind of dismiss my struggle, and they just say, well, you're here now, so you're good. It's like, no, dude, I'm fucking not good. Like, it's, I haven't been good. And they don't ask about that stuff, and they definitely hardly ever ask about my support system. Mm-hmm. And that is what I wouldn't be here without my support system, without my wife, without my kids, without my mom and dad, without my family, without my friends who have stuck by my side, because everybody has those friends that they think they're going to be around forever, and then whatever that intersection is where they lose that friend, I don't even like to think about those circumstances, because then I think about my own friends and think, what is it going to take for us to not be friends anymore? Versus all the energy and the love that I pour into the people I care about, the people that are close to me. And even at my job at Warriors in Quiet Waters, it's, for me, it's been critical throughout my entire life, but especially after I was wounded. If I didn't have everybody that I do have, I don't know where I'd be, to be honest. And that's what I look for when I meet somebody who I know who has been through a struggle, whether it's, again, like, whether it's big or small, people who struggle with addiction, people who have, you know, mental health issues, people are struggling even in their marriage, people who, you know, twisted their ankle, you know, and it's like detrimental to their job or to what they do every day. You know, there's a lot to be said about anybody's support system, but I think there's even more to be said for those dudes and gals that do that shit all on their own. I mean, you talk about resiliency. Mm-hmm. I know so many of those guys and gals that have literally no one. And, you know, going back to like the beginning of humanity, everybody was, you know, inherently flocking to each other to try to find their tribe or find their pack, but not for friendship. They were trying to find it for survival. Mm-hmm. I think that still carries over to today in a sense, because when we have, I believe that when we have those strong connections and those people who, you know, especially those people who make us, that have been through trauma, that make us feel safe, mm-hmm. then I feel like I'm going to survive. And that's everything to me. So like with my wife, with you know, in others, it's like that, like it's almost like going back to like that primal stage of human development of now I'm just trying to survive, but at the same time now in 2021 I'm also trying to thrive. And with that kind of support, I believe I can. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why I have. And I use thrive very loosely because I still have a lot of fucking work to do. And it's a pursuit. It's not said and done. Mm-hmm. It's constantly knocking in my brain about how can I be better, but more importantly, how can I be better to everybody else? And granted, there's people out there that, you know, I'm a firm believer too. Punishment has to fit the crime. And, you know, if you get to a certain level where empathy and compassion isn't paying off, and you then have to turn and look at your own safety or your own well-being, then use your best judgment and do what you need to. Because I think everybody deserves to be treated in the way, like, what's the golden rule? Treat everybody like you want to be treated. Mm-hmm. Man, that shit is not getting hammered home like it should be anymore. Like, if you're an asshole to somebody, so that's how you want to be treated? You want to be treated like an asshole back? That sucks.
Yeah.
What a way to live.
Right.
I don't dig that at all. Versus, you know, being in somebody's life, I feel like is an honor. When somebody lets you into their life, when somebody shares things with you and not only appreciates your struggle, but acknowledges it, mm-hmm. that's huge to me. And I hope everybody listening has at least one person in their life that they could go to. That one person, like, you know, that one person that'll show up for them mm-hmm. when they need them. That one person that'll have a giggle with them. That one person that knows what they need before they even need it. You know, my wife is the master at that. She knows exactly what's going on with me before I even know it. Mm-hmm. And I just, man, I really hope everybody has just one person like that. Whether it's temporary or long term, man. And if you don't have one, god damn it, I'll help you find one. Because I think everybody needs that, not only as a person, but just as a human.
Yeah.
And especially if you're struggling, especially if you have things going on.
So that's kind of a good transition. Yeah. If you want to transition into talking about warriors in quiet waters.
Totally.
Especially if you don't have somebody.
Oh yeah.
Unless you're not done. I don't want to push you along, but I was like, "Ooh."
No, we're right there. That's actually where I was going to go. You know, so flash forward to what I do and what we do at Warriors in Quiet Waters. You know, that a lot of so we serve post 9/11 combat veterans. And combat veterans is a term that's interpreted, you know, differently depending on who you talk to. But the way I interpret it is you have to have been engaged with the enemy in a combat theater at some point. And there's different ways at my job how I verify that, and whether it's through conversation or reviewing their service documents and a plethora of other things. But that's who we serve. And I don't want to put the perception out there that everybody that we bring through is broken. Because I still see that going around so much that's the perception of veterans, is that we're all broken, that we're all grenades just waiting to go off, which is not the case. Mm-hmm. If maybe a little empathy was thrown their way, maybe a little compassion and a little bit of understanding of like, yeah, dude, you've been through some shit, let's talk. That would help so much. And at Warriors in Quiet Waters, through the medium of fly fishing, which is, for anybody who's never done fly fishing, it's a very, very peaceful, very opposite of war occupation. And I've kind of subquoted a quote from a man named Luis Martin, who said, fishing is a solace. It's the opposite of war, a gentle and healing occupation. Which is just, it just rings so true to this day. And Warriors in Quiet Waters started back in 2007, and it was started by a former Marine colonel, fighter pilot named Eric Hastings, who is a very, very dear friend of mine. Talk about one of those people that show up for me and who I would show up for. Eric Hastings, he's been kind of like another father to me and a mentor. And he started this with his loving wife, who just, you know, recently passed after a long, long fight with cancer. And it was actually her brainchild. It was the genesis of it was them fishing in Canada. And she said, this was at like the peak of, one of the peaks during the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, was she was like, you know what? Marines could use this. Because Eric, you know, flashback a little bit, Eric, when he was flying missions, lots of missions over Vietnam, he flew A4 Skyhawks. He flew so many combat missions. And when he got back from Vietnam, that's where he found his solace and his peace, was fly fishing. That's what he grew up doing. That's what he loved. And he credits fly fishing to keeping him here. Mm-hmm. And so fast forward again, back to when they were fishing in Canada, and Gene brought up the idea that, you know what, there's so many Marines that could use this, like this, what we're doing right now. And Eric was like, let's do it. And so they did. And that's what we do now. It is, you know, inherently, like, so through the medium of fly fishing, the awesome volunteers and staff that we surround all of our warriors through, or that we surround our warriors with, it increases their support system. And there's been a lot of participants that come through that don't have, like I said before, they don't have a support system at home. One element that we include on our FXs, we call them FXs for fishing experience. One element that we have at the ranch is a mom crew, and they do all the meals for the ranch or for the week. But at the same time, they're moms. And I can't tell you how many times guys and gals have come through and said, you know what, it was really nice to have a mom again. And a lot of those volunteers, a lot of those moms still talk to the warriors that they were on their FXs with. So, boom, support system increased. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge piece of what happens, and it happens organically, really. But those guys and gals go home and they know that they have a place in Montana, that they have people in Montana that care about them, that if they called, a lot of them would show up, that a lot of them would be an ear to listen to, that that would be a source of empathy or compassion or whatever they need at that time of their life. If they have no one else to call, they know that they could find that with the people they met at Warriors in Quiet Waters. And that's been proven time and time again. I can't tell you how many times. And, you know, going to the outcomes of what we do, I mean, we're actually in the process, we're actually in partnership right now with Syracuse University and the Institute for Veteran and Military Families, it's IVMF for short, and they are the leader in statistical research and data gathering for all things military. So what we're trying to do right now with them is actually quantify those outcomes. Mm-hmm. Because we know they're there with all of the testimonials we've received, all the conversations I've had with, so we have tons of qualitative data, but none of that can actually be put to numbers. So with that, once we get through this year and we have that data, I mean, it's going to be there on set in stone on paper, the outcomes that we facilitate. I'm not going to say that we provide. I think we're like that. We're another one of those intersections where the warriors come through and they leave better.
Yeah.
And we're going to have the data to back that up pretty soon.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So, side note to that, I really love what I do.
That's cool.
So, yeah. So, I'm the director of programs there. And I have a phenomenal deputy director with Audrey Chorak. She's been a lot. She's just been, I mean, she's a huge part of why our program is successful now. And I mean, it always has been, but she just made it better. And then the rest of the staff, with our development team, with Emily, with Stevie, with Liz, they just do so much awesome work when it comes to fundraising and getting our name out there, getting our story, getting the warrior stories out there. They do an awesome job. And then you got Mike Powell, who's our director of admin and evaluation. He's a Marine, former Cobra pilot. And then Adam Remillard, he's our controller. He handles all of our money and he does it really well.
He's, I need one of those.
He's phenomenal. He's one of those Excel whizzes that you just give him a number and he just knocks it out. Like, it's crazy. And then one of our newest additions was Casey Giles, our new volunteer and program coordinator. She's been great. And then Jesse Leneve. To anybody listening, you can just Google him, and he's like, there's nobody in Bozeman that doesn't know Jesse, and he's the fishing operations manager for us. And talk about a guy who gives everything that he has to the Warriors. He just dedicates himself to who we serve, and it's incredible. I love working with all of them, and they're a huge part of why I love my job. And, you know, lastly, Brian Gilman, who recently retired last year in July, and he came from, he's a former Marine colonel, and his last duty station was MARSOC, which is Marine Special Operations Command. And talk about him jumping into that pilot seat as executive director and just being the leader that I knew was going to precede him. It's just awesome. And everybody is so in tune with what we do, how we do it, and why we do it. Mm-hmm. The why is the biggest thing. You know, a lot of people, speaking of questions people should ask, people should be asking, like, what's the why of what you're doing? Mm-hmm. Because without the why, it's like, okay, so you're doing this for what? And if the why isn't, like, that great, that's fine. That's still their why. And I don't want to take that away from anybody. But, you know, everybody on the staff at Warriors and Quiet Waters, the volunteers that we place, the moms that we place, the phenomenal guides that we use in the valley, they all know the why. And the why is our Warriors. And to not only help them reintegrate, whether depending on which point they are in their transition, but also to, again, increase that support system and be there for somebody or for those Warriors. I can't say enough good things about what I do. I've been there, it'll be 6 years pretty soon as staff, and then I volunteered for 4 years before that. And actually, I should mention, I came through as a participant myself back in 2009 when I was still active duty. It's actually how I discovered Bozeman.
Really?
Yeah. And from there, it took us about a year to get out of the Army, but then another 7-8 months to find a house here, build it, and then move up here. And then our daughter was actually born here, so we got a Montana baby. Like, it's it's just been, we have zero regrets about the move that we made. But do we miss our families? Of course we miss our families. But a silver lining to that is, now that we're away, it's like every time that we see them now, it's like even more special. Mm-hmm. It just feels really good. You know, when I think of home, I think of I could be myself. And I take that very, I hold that very close, put it mm-hmm. that way. Like, when I could just be me, man, do I dig it. Like, it's just, it's so nice. Like, it's, especially if I can, like, I don't really like to have my legs off in front of people. That's just a thing that I am still trying to work through, is just, it's not that because people really haven't earned it. I just feel like I try to be good at checking vibes and, you know, and trying to figure out, like, okay, who's one of my wheelchair friends? Like, who are those friends that I don't mind if they see me in my wheelchair or with my legs off, for that matter? And those people are really, really special to me. But that's not to say that all the other acquaintances and the people I know and the people I've connected with aren't special to me. It's just, you know, maybe special in a different way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so making Montana our home, yeah, we have no regrets. And when we go to our home in Southern California, and I get my awesome cooking from all of my aunts, and oh my god, yeah,
I was an Iowa girl that yeah. moved out to Southern California, so mm-hmm. I was like, bland food. All of, I mean, not that we didn't have good food, but we're like, potatoes, meat and potatoes. Sure, and I moved to Southern California not ever eating avocados or onions or peppers.
Oh.
And I dated a man whose sister was married to a Mexican and his mom and everybody else. And I was like very, I would have starved if I didn't eat. And by, after a while, I was like, this stuff is so good.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah. It's like, I mean, you ever met a person that doesn't like Mexican food?
No.
I don't think, I think the two times that I've had, that I have met somebody that's just like, oh, yeah, I don't really like Mexican food. And then I'm just like,
yeah, like, Taco Bell is not Mexican food.
Right? Oh, my God, right. Like, oh, there's people, why do people think Taco Bell is Mexican food? I don't
understand. It's good drunk food, but it's not like good, authentic food. But
I will slam, man, I will slam some quesadillas from Taco Bell. Like,
yeah.
It's like it's good for that, but it is not even in the same universe as Mexican food.
No, no.
So, you know, when we go home, it's really special to us. It's special to our families. And it's just really one more thing on food is, God dang it. When I go home, this is something I really just, oh God, I love it so much. When I go home, my aunts always ask me, mijo, ¿qué quieres comer cuando vengas? What do you want to eat when you come down? And I just tell them my favorite things that they make, and then I have them when we're done. Like, I already know what I'm getting into when I'm down there. Like, even though they could put whatever they want in front of me, I will eat whatever they put, because it's all just so good, and it all, it doesn't taste good, but more so, it tastes like home. Like, it just, man, I just feel.
What's your favorite thing that you request?
Man, that's a tough one.
It's coming up on noon. That's why I think we're hungry now.
Man, I don't know. Probably carne con chile. It's basically like, kind of like chile verde, but better.
Okay.
I slam so much of it when I'm down there. And, you know, chile rellenos, my Aunt Sylvia makes those, and they're just, everything they make is so good.
With the cheese and stuff inside.
Oh, yeah. And she makes it in her way. Like, all of them, every Mexican family has their certain people that make things in certain ways. Like, one aunt's rice might not be as good as this aunt's rice, and then that aunt's beans will be way better than the other aunt's beans. Or, like, this aunt's, the way she flips tortillas is different how she flips tortillas. Like, it's, there's all those little nuances that only each Mexican family knows about each other, and it's, I think that's really special too, especially when you meet, you know, other folks from any culture, really, and you can kind of exchange those little pieces that make, you know, home special. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
But what are we looking like on time?
We're at bar 1365. Okay. I don't know what that means. Whatever that means. It's 11:30, so I'm guessing we're at about 40 minutes.
Okay.
So if you want to wrap up a little bit, or like tell people where they can find your program, where they can find you, if you want them to find
totally,
you.
Totally.
And so, how they go about applying, that type of stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. So I'll do that. I'll, throw out some Warriors and Car Water stuff. And then I want to wrap up with, I want to go back to the support system thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll try to wrap it up in a way. I just thought about it. So it might come out a little weird, but I think it'll be all right. But with Warriors and Quiet Waters, you can go to our website, warriorsandquietwaters.org. And if you are a combat vet, male or female or other, go to the Warrior info page. And at the top, there's a submit inquiry button that, you know, click on that. We'll get your info. We'll have it on file. So that way, because of COVID last year, we had to cancel on over 170 participants. So we had to bring all of them forward to this year, along with all the new participants that were on our standby list. So we were totally full for this year. We actually didn't open the application, but for next year, we're going to open it. And by submitting that inquiry form, we'll have you on file, and we will let you know when our application opens up again. And myself and our deputy director, Audrey Chorak, we do all the evaluation, and we look at everybody's service documents they submit. All the info's there. So if you could use a hand, even if you're doing okay, but you could use a break for respite, for connection, maybe find that camaraderie again if you've been out of the military for a while. please submit an inquiry and get your application in when we open. So the thing I want to say about support systems is I hope, and I saw your other interview with that guy named John, who was a veteran but lost his leg in a roofing accident, I think it was.
He wasn't a veteran.
No, he wasn't? Oh, mm-hmm. Okay, interesting. Well, either way, he lost a leg. That's mm-hmm. tough. That's tough. And when he said, you know, he wants his experience to be the blueprint for other people that are struggling, mm-hmm. oh man, I really dug that.
He's an awesome person.
I really, really dug that. And he mentioned his wife, and so I'm going to try to frame it in a different way, if I may. I really like movies, and actually, I don't really like movies. I fucking love movies. I dig everything about them. I dig the acting and the way it's put together. I've actually worked with.
I saw you were on an AT&T commercial.
Yeah, so that's actually your autograph. So on that shoot, I actually worked with directors Valerie Faris and John Dayton, who are, you know, tier one directors, and I got to watch them in action. So that's another thing I do is whenever I'm anywhere, I try to absorb information and I try to observe. And when I was on that shoot with them, my God, was it like a dream come true, like being on an actual set. And so what I want to say about support system and how it relates to me for movies is everybody sees Leo, right? Everybody sees Leo DiCaprio. Everybody sees Andy Dufresne as he's kneeling when he escapes from Shawshank. Sorry for the spoiler. It came out in 1994. You guys should have watched it already. Like, everybody sees those shots that are just so iconic, and they just stick with you forever. Or, you know, Keanu Reeves in Speed. Like, it's me and my kids just watched that one, so it's, like, fresh in my mind. But everybody sees those shots, and I feel like that's all most people give a shit about is, oh, man, I'm watching Leo in The Revenant, and I'm watching him get his revenge. Like, but hardly anybody ever looks at what did it take to get that shot. Mm-hmm. What I feel right now, kind of how I mentioned before, when people say, like, ah, oh, you're doing great, you're doing this, blah, 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 that's the shot, okay? Mm-hmm. I feel like that's the shot. I really wish people would look at the rest of the production. Mm-hmm. And that's everybody that's hustling behind the scenes, putting up lights, making sure special effects are lined up, making sure that everybody's where they need to be at the right place and the right time at the precise moment in order to, and the directors, the assistant directors, the producers, everybody that's watching on monitors from afar, there's hundreds of moving pieces that are involved to get this one shot. And there's a lot of struggle involved with all those moving pieces.
That's why every movie has a montage.
That's why every
movie... It's really fast forward. Totally. It's all the work, too.
Totally. So all the work that goes into getting that shot or making that movie... Oh, like, does that sound kind of like... No, okay. I'll just go with it. I'm not trying to say I'm a movie. I'm trying to say that... Start looking behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And see how many people it takes to get that shot. Mm-hmm. Because I think you'll appreciate it a lot more. And that goes for anybody. Everybody's their own shot in a movie. Everybody's their own icon. And I don't care who you are. I don't care what color you are. I don't care if you're in a chair. I don't care if you can't wear legs. I don't care. Like, whatever it is, you are your own shot. You're your own icon. Let's start asking people about how they got that shot.
Love it. All right. Thank you so much for being here. Like, this was, I have chills. I'm like, that was so good. Like, a couple of times, like, that was awesome. Thank you.
No, thank you so much for having us and for letting me talk about Warriors in Quiet Waters, because they are a huge part of where I am today.
Love it. All right. I'm going to end this, even though I could probably talk to you for, like, cool. Another 2 hours.
All good.